This is KRCU's Going Public, and I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. Missouri lawmakers have sought to overhaul rules over their behavior for years with mixed success. But these efforts are getting a higher profile after Governor Eric Greitens made cleaning up Missouri politics a priority. St. Louis Public Radio's Jason Rosenbaum checks in on what the Republican governor wants to do and whether it will actually improve the Capitol culture.
If Missourians were near a television over the past year, they probably caught wind of how Eric Greitens wanted to overhaul the ethical culture in Jefferson City. His advertisements weren't exactly a study in subtlety.
For too long, Missouri's been run by career politicians, owned by corrupt consultants, high-paid lobbyists, and special interests. While they get rich, Missourians are hurting.
Now that Greitens is governor, he can't just rely on rhetorical flourishes to get his words translated into laws. Instead, Greitens will need to depend on some of the politicians he derided in those ads. So after he ascended the dais at his first State of the State address, Greitens made it clear to the state's elected officials that ethics would be a top priority for his administration.
Too many good, strong public servants have come here only to see the will of the people obstructed and too often corrupted by insiders and by lobbyists.
Greitens ticked off several major priorities, banning legislators from taking meals, entertainment, and travel from lobbyists, expanding a cooling-off period before legislators can lobby, and amending the Missouri Constitution to apply term limits to all statewide officials. At this early point in the legislative session, the term limit and cooling-off period bills haven't gone terribly far in the process. But a bill largely curtailing lobbyist freebies passed the House fairly quickly and nabbed support from top Republican leaders like House Speaker Todd Richardson of Poplar Bluff.
The combination of things that we're trying to do to improve overall the culture here in Jeff City will improve the environment here. And beyond that, I think it's just the right thing to do.
Lawmakers have been trying to rein in lobbyist freebies for quite some time. Detractors of the practice say it gives representatives of powerful interest groups a slice of time that wouldn't be afforded to ordinary citizens. Even some lobbyists like former State Representative Rodney Hubbard are not exactly enthusiastic about catering to lawmakers' whims. Here's what he had to say in 2015.
80-90% of people you ever talk to about an issue are already where they're going to be anyway. And so when it comes to the wine and dining, it takes up a lot of your time. You know, you could be at a baseball game, you could be at a football game, but most people would rather be out with their families.
Despite some early legislative momentum, there's no guarantee that lawmakers will end up passing ethics-related bills this year. Efforts to pass strict lobbyist gift bans and longer cooling-off periods have often run into Senate opposition. Some lawmakers in that chamber, like Republican State Senator Dave Schatz of Sullivan, believe the public perception of lobbyists is misunderstood.
People have a negative connotation toward lobbyists. Lobbyists are people that provide information. And so I think there's a misunderstanding sometimes about what a lobbyist does.
Senate President Pro Tem Ron Richards says he's supportive of tighter ethics laws. But the Joplin Republican emphasized that rules don't always stop people from behaving unethically. He recounted a threat he made to his colleagues when he was Speaker of the House.
If you do something to embarrass me or your other members, I will strip you of all your committees. I will strip you of your parking spot. And that lasted about 2 hours. And some of these guys started acting up again.
Richard says lawmakers need to exercise self-control and hold themselves accountable.
I do know right from wrong, and I do know that, you know, don't do something your mother wouldn't want you to do.
In any case, House and Senate leaders say they're beginning their ethics push early to haggle out disagreements before session ends in May. And with a Republican governor nudging them forward, the GOP-controlled legislature may have a little extra urgency to get ethics bills past the finish line. I'm Jason Rosenbaum.
To hear this story again, visit our website at krcu.org. Last year, the Cape Girardeau Police Department implemented a new crisis intervention training for its officers. Earlier this week, I spoke with Cape Girardeau Police Chief Wes Blair about the success of the training, the department's ongoing community initiatives, and an update on the current status of the new police facility set for completion in 2018. Here's our conversation. What is the current state for the new police station that's being built? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I sure can. We're still really, really excited about the progress that we're making on that and that we're staying within our budget. If you've been by recently, you'll see that some of the walls are starting to come up, and those are the walls around the jail section because those are I guess, the more fortified walls, and so that's what they're constructing right now. And we hope to be in probably February or March of 2018, depending on how, you know, weather will hold out for the builders between now and then. But we're really, really excited about it.
And just for a refresher, what all is going into that building? What will it look like?
Right. So inside that building will be all of police operations. There will be a 20-bed jail. And then court will also be housed in one area of the building. They'll have their own separate entrance. They're their own separate entity. We're just sharing building space. And there's some convenience with that, because as prisoners right now, when we have to take a prisoner to court, we take them out of the jail, load them up in a van, drive them over to the courthouse, and then come back, you know, do the reverse trip. With this, we'll be able to move them from the jail portion itself across a hallway to the courtroom. So, you know, it will save money, it saves time, reduces the risk of escape, reduces the risk of injury, and all those things. So that's a big benefit for us. One of the other things that we're really, really excited about is, especially since we're in the park setting, is that there's going to be a room that is a community room that citizens can rent out for various functions. If they need to have a meeting of some kind or something like that, they can utilize that space, and we'll have that open to the public. So it's another way of saying that it's not just our building, but it's your building. You know, it's the citizens' building, and we want all of the city of Cape Girardeau to feel like that is their building and something they can be proud of.
So is this, in a way, this new police station, will it improve community policing efforts in the city of Cape?
I hope so. I mean, that's kind of what we would like to see happen with it, is that, again, just by having that space that is the communities, then that just builds that interaction and it builds that bond between the citizens and the police.
And I want to talk a little bit about going off of that new community initiatives within the police department. What do you all have planned so far for 2017?
Right now, mostly a continuation of a lot of the programs that we've been doing. You know, the coffee with cops, the neighborhood roll calls. We're actually kind of going to increase some of the neighborhood functions that we're doing, you know, we'll call them block parties or whatever. We're still kind of working out the details of those. But just more opportunities for us to be able just to engage with the citizens, not in a police function, just as, you know, human being to human being, getting to know each other and hearing about people's concerns and those kind of things. So you'll see some of that. Where we've got this little free library in front of our police station now, where we've seen kids constantly coming and going, bringing books, taking books, things like that. It's just a good way to say, hey, we're part of the community. You know, we've got books for you. If you want to come read a book, come get a book. So those kind of things that we are going to keep working on and hope to build attendance at those. And kind of expand that. I mean, obviously you don't want to start doing so many programs that then they just become so saturated and then everybody loses interest. So we don't want to oversaturate the community with our presence, but, you know, we want to find that right balance that we can work together and break bread together and have a good time together and really get to know each other.
Well, when we're talking about community, there is something that your department implemented, I believe, last year when it came to the crisis intervention training. And just for a reminder for our listeners, this program focused on de-escalation tactics for officers who respond to mental health related type calls. How have you all seen as a department a change in the responses or how they're responding to these cases or calls based upon this training now?
Yeah, the change has been huge. You know, when I first came into police work, there was no such thing as crisis intervention training. There was no such thing as recognizing people with mentally disturbed, going through psychosis or anything like that. It was, you know, you were hands-on and you just did police work. But so many of our citizens now suffer from just disabilities of whatever kind. So it was really important to train our officers on recognizing what some of the symptoms are of different mental states, and be able to approach it knowing, okay, well, this person is acting in certain manners, so, and not that they have to be a doctor and be able to diagnose within 3 seconds of arriving on the scene, but at least have some indicators of, okay, well, if this person's dealing with this, then I can respond to them in a different way, and maybe de-escalate the situation like that. And having put these officers, gotten them through the training and put them on the street, we've seen some tremendous benefits with that. We've seen the number of calls being reduced because not only are we responding to them differently, but we're also working very, very diligently with mental health partners in the community, community counseling for one, to get these people to the help that they need, as opposed to just putting them in jail. Because having a mental disability or psychosis is not a crime. I mean, it's a medical problem. It's an issue that needs to be addressed, not just jailed. So by working with the community counseling and being proactive, even with people that we've identified that have these issues, doing proactive follow-up with them before they have another episode, has already paid dividends and reduced our call load to those type of people. And our goal is to eventually try to have every officer on every shift trained like that, so that you're not having to call an officer that's trained over the officer that arrives already has that knowledge in his tool belt.
Coming up, we'll hear more of my interview with Cape Girardeau Police Chief Wes Blair and much more after the break.
I'm Ari Shapiro. If you find NPR reliable and comforting, you're not alone. If your old car is a bit less than reliable, well, you're not alone either. Donate your car to us and turn it into the programs you love.
Visit KRCU.org and click on support for all the details.
We're back with KRCU's Going Public, and I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. Before the break, I spoke with Cape Girardeau Police Chief Wes Blair. Here's more from that conversation. What are your hopes and plans for the city of Cape in Cape Girardeau in 2017?
My biggest hope is that we can get to a place where our citizens feel safe no matter where they are in the community or what they're doing. We reduced crime again this year in a very turbulent year across the nation, but our crime reduced by almost 13%. And that's huge numbers when, all you see on TV is shooting after shooting after shooting. And we still do have a fair share of shooting calls, but that would be the thing that we would really like to try to reduce and that we're really wanting to take some steps to really address the violence in our community and the gun violence and why are people resorting to gun violence. And so that's going to probably be our big focus this next year, just as it was this last year, is trying to get all these illegal guns out of the hands of people who don't need them on the streets and reduce the shootings that we have.
And how do you go about approaching that?
It takes a community effort. There's the education piece that is really important with our social services and our schools, and even with our school resource officers who are actually in the schools and building, they're their own little mini community-oriented policing department, our school resource officers are, because they're in the schools building relationships with the kids every single day. And that's a very critical piece of combating gun violence, because then they're showing those kids, hey, there's really a better way. There's a better way to solve disputes. So that's one piece of it. Prosecuting gun crimes, we've got to have the help of our prosecuting attorneys, and they really are very much on board with us, helping us with that. Prosecuting those gun crimes and getting those violent offenders, those violent repeat offenders off the streets. And so it's going to take a collaborative effort of all of us, working to make that happen. And the biggest thing that, like I've always said, is if you see something, call us. That's where the whole community piece, policing piece, comes full circle. People see something, they call us, we respond to it, and then we can take action, as opposed to the older days when people are like, well, I don't want to get involved, that's not my problem, that's not my business, nobody's going to do anything about it anyway. I think the community policing piece that we're doing is starting to show people that, hey, these guys and gals at the police department, they're part of our community, and they want it to be fixed just like we do. And so I think I'm going to help them and call them the next time that I see something that looks a little suspicious before it becomes a shooting. And, I can point back to, unfortunately, the 5 shootings that resulted in death this last year. And I don't want to discount that those are very unfortunate incidents and should never have happened. But because people talk to us, we solved all 5 of them this year.
Well, thank you so much. I always enjoy talking to you, Chief Blair.
Well, thank you, Marissa, and I enjoyed it as well.
To hear this story again, visit our website at krcu.org. Southeast Missouri State University's River Campus will be hosting their Mid-South Horn Workshop in March. In addition to holding master classes and catering to hundreds of horn players from across the region, they will also feature performers from the St. Louis Symphony, the Czech Philharmonic, and the Colorado Symphony. KRCU's Lindsay Grogene talked to Southeast Assistant Horn Professor Dr. Nicholas Kinney about their big event.
So, Dr. Kinney, the Mid-South Horn Workshop is coming up soon. Go ahead and tell me about it.
We are having the workshop here at the River Campus. It is a regional workshop sponsored by the International Horn Society that caters to horn players, French horn players, you might have heard it referred to as, but we call ourselves horn players. There will be roughly 250 horn players from the region and beyond here that weekend, and there's a bunch of different events going on.
So I know you all will have a lot of visiting artists coming to the River Campus for this event, several traveling internationally. Go ahead and tell me who will get the opportunity to see perform here in CAPE.
Well, we have about 8 or 9 featured artists from all over the world coming, and there are about 30 contributing artists from the region and beyond coming as well. The headlining events Friday night will be Katerina Javorkova from the Czech Philharmonic. Saturday night will be Todd Bauermaster from the St. Louis Symphony. Saturday afternoon, the St. Louis Symphony Horn Section will be playing a concert in Bedell, and Austin Larson will be here from the Colorado Symphony doing some things on Friday and Sunday.
So why would someone want to come see a horn workshop?
That's a good question. It's definitely catering to a specific people. There will be a lot of university students here. In fact, the bulk of the participants will be, there's about 132 already registered. There will be university professors. There will be just people who enjoy hearing horn or playing horn as a hobby as well. And for the public, it's a really cool thing to see some of these international and national artists come together and play these concerts. You know, of course, I'm biased to the occasion, but it's a very big event that's being put on. And you know, we've got Katerina coming from the Czech Republic, who 2 weeks ago won a Czech Grammy Award, and she's been named the top prize winner in several major international competitions over the past few years, and she's only 26 years old. It's kind of once in a lifetime to see some of this all come together in one place, and it's pretty neat that we have it here on the River Campus. If you're not interested in being around all day to see the workshop, the competitions, and the lectures and things of that nature, the public really wants to be at these nighttime featured events because they're going to be very spectacular. It is over our spring break, but the Wind Ensemble will be here doing part of one of the featured performances as well. So locally, horn players, band directors, and their students are going to want to come and learn. The cool thing about the workshop is it's catered to different things. We've got competitions for people all the way from high school age to graduate school. There are lectures for people who are horn professors to go and learn more about what they're doing. There are performances for horn professors. The Contributing Artists Concert Series has 3 different recitals over the weekend, and it features music from all time periods and chamber music, solo music, and everything in between. So it's really catering to a large variety of people, but it's centered around the horn as the base medium.
Now, you're really passionate about the horn, of course. What inspired you to put this on for our area?
You know, as part of this, I've been going to these workshops since I was 18 years old. In fact, my first one was 15 years ago, this time of year. So I got to go to one and it really inspired me. And when I first was hired at Southeast, I went directly to our department chair and said, you know, this is something I want to do. I put in a bid for it and it was accepted. So I've been planning this event for 2 years. And, you know, really it's a professional thing for me and for my colleagues in the business. But the great thing about it is not only am I reaching out to my professional colleagues around the region and even some beyond. We have some artists coming from Wyoming, Florida, and North Carolina, but it also really gives the Southeast community a chance to really hear what the horn can do. Besides, you know, seeing us in the back of the orchestra, it puts the horn out front as the main thing. And it's pretty exceptional that we're going to get to have that here.
Okay, perfect. So go ahead and tell me how people can get their tickets for this.
So ticket prices for the featured events on Friday night, Saturday afternoon, and Saturday night are $12 for each concert. If you wanted to purchase a complete day pass, you can online, and it's $35, and you could come for a whole day. If you wanted to register for the entire workshop, it's $85 for an adult, $75 for students at this point. But the day pass will get you into every event at the university that day. So all the regional recitals, all the regional artist recitals, and the featured artist recitals at night. You can purchase those through the box office. You can go to the website. It's cmo.edu/horn to purchase day or weekend passes, or you can email me, nkenny@cmo.edu, for information if you have any other questions.
All right. Thank you for your time, Dr. Kenny. And you heard him. The dates for this are March 17th through the 19th. The workshop will start that Friday around 8 a.m. with competitions and in Sunday afternoon around 2:30 p.m.
That's our show. You can find these stories on our website at krcu.org or find us on iTunes to hear this podcast. I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. Join me every Friday night at 6 and Sundays at 3 for KRCU's Going Public.